Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki, recorded on Thursday, October 14th, 2010. Taking science online. Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Kiki. This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour, episode 68. And in this episode, as usual, we're spending an entire hour diving into a single subject with a single expert. And this expert is an expert in science and taking it into the online realm. Boris Zivkovich, he is the chief editor and community manager of Scientific American Blogs, previously the community manager at the Public Library of Science website. And he additionally is one of the founders and directors of the Science Online Conference, which has grown over the last several years from a very small conference on science in the online realm to a 400-person conference with people from all over the world who come to visit the Research Triangle area of the United States over in North Carolina. So, Bora, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Great to be here.
Yeah, on such short notice as well, and I do appreciate that. Can you tell us what the impetus behind getting the Science Online Conference started was? Like, what initiated that?
I can start with prehistory, with why triangle? Because North Carolina has a lot of great universities. UNC in Chapel Hill is the first public university in the country. Then there's Duke. There's a huge land-grant university at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. A lot of other universities around the state. And in the first half of the 20th century, all the people who got this wonderful education here had to leave elsewhere to find jobs. So the state of North Carolina decided to do something about it and dedicated a large tract of land in the triangle between Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill and built a Research Triangle Park with such wonderful companies like RTI, SAS, IBM, Glaxo, Quintiles, and a lot of, some of them are homegrown, born here, like Lulu.com and various centers and institutes that do science. So there's not just science, but also technology for 51 years now. And this marriage between science and technology is something that has really colored the Triangle area. And resulted in a lot of people who are related to both tech and science starting to explore the internet, the web, and blogging a long time ago. There's a number of people in the area who have been blogging for 8, 10, 12 years. They had to hand code their blogs because the commercial software was not existing at the time when they started. So there's a long tradition here of good science and of kind of pioneering use of online technologies. So my friend Anton Zeiker and I thought that we should really try to help these two worlds get closer to each other, start talking a little bit better to each other, the tech world and the science world. We felt they were still not talking to each other very well. So we decided to make a small local conference. We called it Triangle Science Blogging Conference, and it was hosted on the UNC campus. That was almost 5 years ago. And we invited local bloggers, local programmers, local scientists, students, to come to the conference, and we had about 130 something people, but surprisingly they came from several countries and from all around the United States. So it was immediately the first year it was a surprise how much it was covered and how much people had an interest in this. And as you said, over the past years it has grown to the point that now we are looking for a larger venue so we can accommodate maybe as many as 500 people. I mean, last year we had people from, I think, 9 countries, including New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Poland, Serbia, from all around the world and all around the country, Canada, UK, of course. And so it's become an international conference. And what is really interesting about it is that it's not just 3 days in January when people come here and discuss science and the web and schmooze and network, but it's something that lives on blogs and especially on Twitter throughout the year. The hashtag on Twitter that we use, SCIO11, has been in constant use throughout the year. So it's a living conference that, you know, people get together in person for 3 days, but then continue discussion throughout the year online.
And just trying to bring up some results on the web for the SCIO 11 hashtag to see what's up there. The really interesting thing to me is that, like you said, there's a really multinational, international attendance at this conference. It just, I really think, speaks to the fact that blogging and science and and not just blogging, but video blogging, podcasts, any possible way that you can bring science online, it doesn't stay in one location. It allows people from all over to become a part of it.
Yes, which is wonderful. Science itself is global and doesn't really recognize borders. If it's discovered in Germany, the French people can know it. So this new online technology just makes it easier, makes it natural. Why should knowledge about the way the world works belong to any particular country? So web is speeding up this exchange of ideas and exchange of information around the globe, and that's how it should be.
Do you think, have you noticed any dramatic differences in the people who attend or in the topics that are being discussed from the first year that the conference began 5 years ago to, say, last year's conference and now the topics that people are talking about bringing into this year's conference? Is there anything major that's changed or shifted?
I don't think it's major. Of course, every year has its own events which color the kind of the key themes of the conference. So the first one was really about introducing blogging to the science world, and then the year after that, open access, still a fight to be fought. I think open access is something that's now here to win. It's shifted last year to very much towards the future of science journalism, because journalism and media in general is in big upheaval with, you know, newspapers closing, newsrooms being cut to the bone, and especially science coverage being the first to go in many places, from, you know, CNN to various newspapers. So last year was really colored by the state of science journalism and the science in the mainstream media, and how the web can pitch in and make it better. So we don't know yet what is going to be the theme, what is going to emerge as a theme of the next one. We have a planning wiki on which people are putting their suggestions for topics, and things that are burning topics for them are going to become sessions that we are going to discuss in January.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great aspects of your conference. It's kind of like an unconference where people come with their ideas. However, there are months of planning and pulling those ideas together, so people can actually put together some pretty interesting presentations and plan for it pretty well. And like you said, it seems it's a conference where the attendees make the schedule, where the attendees decide on what is going to be the topic of interest that they're going to want to discuss.
Yes, we go by the rule that you know, these several hundred people know more and understand the world better than Anton and I do. So this is what transfers into the way we are organizing the conference. We do help the process along, and we may inform some interesting people to us that the conference exists, that they are welcome, and that it would be very nice if they do a session there. But we don't really invite and say, okay, you do this session under this title. It is much more open. It is crowdsourced to a large degree, what topics and what sessions. We try to make it balance as far as, you know, variety of topics. So all the attendees have, you know, several sessions that they'll be interested in, that people who are watching us online, either, you know, on video or over Twitter, will find always, you know, at each time slot, a session or two they'll be interested in to follow. We are also very concerned that our session leaders, we have a balance as far as age and gender and background in science or technology. So it is not like your typical techie conference or a typical science conference where 90% of the people are looking like me, 40, white, male. So right. We've been very successful in working that kind of manipulating the process of crowdsourcing a little bit to get that balance. And for instance, last year we had it would be exactly half and half, but we had one extra woman as far as gender breakdown, for instance. So that makes the conference much more welcoming to everybody. People now know that this is a place where everybody's even, everybody's equal. There are no superstars and others or also-rans. Everybody's superstar in their own domain, and everybody has something to teach and everybody has something to learn. And so that makes the conference very, very pleasant, very comfortable for everybody. Everybody has something to contribute.
Yeah. Do you think that there are more attendees now? I mean, you said that one of the important aspects of this is bringing the science world and the tech world closer together, getting a little bit more collaboration. Have you seen results of that effort from the conference, or from what people have told you they've learned from the conference?
Yes, it's hard to quantify, but there is quite a lot. And interestingly, not so much locally, but internationally, where people learn something from the conference and then take it home and teach a class or give seminars or involve their colleagues to get them online, to get them started on blogging or podcasting or things like that. Collaborations have started. People have published scientific papers coming from those collaborations, and maybe they first met at Science Online. So, yeah, things happen. I don't always even know of everything that's happened that maybe directly or indirectly came from, you know, two people sharing a meal at Science Online.
What are some of the most, I think, impactful stories or impactful results of the conference that you've noticed?
Results. That's hard to tell. Everybody's happiness at the end of the conference is the biggest result for me. Satisfaction for Anton and myself that we have done something right, that everybody is very excited during and after the conference and talks about it. I think our conference has in many ways legitimized online world, and especially blogging, in some areas that were resistant, especially with some, let's say, institutions and scientific societies, publishers of the old style, who, you know, sent their representatives or watched online and decided because of that to take a plunge online and give it a try. Start a blog or just treat bloggers as equals if they didn't before. So those are lots of small things. I can't point to like one big thing that happened because of Science Online. I mean, the event itself is usually a place where some other, some new website or some new action is first shown to the world. For instance, Science Blogs Brazil was announced at Science Online. ResearchBlogging.org was announced at Science Online. AkaWiki. So things like that, you know, people like to announce or unveil their sites at Science Online because they know that the a large number of people are going to watch it and not just be there, but watch it online. And those are just the kind of audiences that people who are developing such sites are most interested in.
There's a question in the chat room. Ambrose is wondering if you can comment at all on the lack of R&D that's spreading beyond Research Triangle Park. He says that we here in Charlotte are totally disconnected from your excellent efforts. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. Because we want to work with people in Charlotte. And it kind of started very late, just before the last Science Online, through really people associated with Charlotte Observer. Because just before Science Online 2010, Charlotte Observer and Raleigh News and Observer restarted a Monday science technology section. And so several people from Charlotte Observer were here. And so we are hoping, and we've worked with them for the past year, that they will be kind of our point people in Charlotte to try to gather Charlotte scientists and Charlotte bloggers and writers and journalists to bring them to Science Online and to connect the two communities a little better. I mean, we are just an hour away by train. We really should work together better, and I hope we can, that this is just starting to develop.
Yeah, and I think this is, it's not just the question of, you know, Research Triangle Park to Charlotte, which is an hour away. There's also the question of just connecting all sorts of different centers for research and development around the globe. And at this point in time, is there really any central organization? Is there really any group that's trying to bring information from center to center, from individual to individual, aside from maybe just bloggers or, you know, people who are just putting stuff out there? Is there anything organized?
There isn't anything organized for all of it, but for instance, Science Technology Parks, like Research Triangle Park, they have their organization, and we had a conference, their annual conference, here in Raleigh last year, and Research Triangle Park, being 51 years old, is the oldest researcher, such park in the world and the largest in the country, and is seen as a leader in this movement of research parks or science technology parks, and it's a place that other parks around the world are looking at, and so the first 50 years were a great success, but the world is changing with the internet especially. And so there's a lot of questions. Well, why do we need brick and mortar places when we can all communicate online? So this conference and the leadership of RTP is something that is ushering you know, the next 50 years, which is going to be a little bit different. But Research Triangle Park is in the lead, and there is a lot of communication between the global parks. How much, for, you know, at this moment, this involves organizations, companies, individuals, or universities that are not directly associated with the parks, It's probably still a little loose, but hopefully it'll get stronger, because it's one of the things that RTP here is trying to do, to integrate all those aspects of science, R&D, and communication here, and then translate, and hopefully other centers around the world will learn from that experience and do the same.
Yeah, it seems to me that we have the internet, which is an amazing resource for communication, and there's no reason for disparate groups in varying locations to have to reinvent the wheel over and over again. And if there are things that work, those resources, is there some way to get those resources shared? Is there a model that we can learn from? Is there, a central place that people can go to for, R&D or even just really interesting science information,
That is true. Although, of course, different geographies are going to have different, maybe requirements. They're going to have different environment, let's say political environment or economic environment or cultural environment, so they'll have to tweak it and adapt it to their own circumstances. But I don't know if there is one single kind of central place. Maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe it should be a network of independent organizations who are tinkering and experimenting and learning from each other, and each adapting other people's solutions for their own circumstances. I don't know what is the best way to do it. Maybe it shouldn't be centralized.
Right. Maybe centralization is not necessarily the best way to do it. What got you interested in all of this online science stuff in the first place? I mean, people refer to you as the science blog father. I mean, that's quite a title.
Well, ask my parents. My mother is what is now called a connector. That was before the internet, so she did it in real life. And my father was a very social person and very beloved by everybody. And I think I picked something from both of them. I was in graduate school at NC State University in the Department of Zoology, which is now biology, because zoology and botany fused, studying circadian rhythms for 10 years. Loved it, but, after 10 years, I broke down. I hit the wall, and at the same time got very much involved in politics, because that was 03. So I was thinking, okay, can we get a Democrat elected? I started getting online much more for politics than science. I mean, I was doing my work. I was starting to write my dissertation, which I never finished. I was, reading papers online. But I was at the university. I had access to everything through the library. And it was not something I gave much thought to, but I was discovering the world of politics and political blogs online. After the 2004 election, I was sick of politics. We lost, so what do I do? And by that time, I was already kind of out of grad school, ABD, no PhD, probably not interested in actually working in science anymore. The finances for science were already going, going down into the cellar. Yeah. Kind of future was not there, but I was very interested by that time in online communication. But I decided that, everybody can bash Bush, but I can write about things that I have expertise on and most people do not, and that is circadian rhythms, the stuff I was studying. So I started another blog and wrote a long post about sleep patterns and circadian clocks in humans. And overnight, it got, 30,000, and then another 30,000 hits from Boing Boing and Andrew Sullivan and all those. And I realized, hey, obviously there's interest in this and people trust me because I put my name up there and said, hey, this is what I study. So people took my word as a word of an expert. And I decided, so there's a niche for me to fill, somebody with expertise in something that people are interested in, sleep cycles and other biological rhythms. People are interested in this. So I continued writing about that. And about a year later, I got invited to join scienceblogs.com by Seed Media Group. Actually, chronologically, not the first, but the first big one that made a real big splash, and a network that all the mainstream media started following because it was indexed in Google News, not just Google. And so it became, for many people who are not, wonks, but, you know, let's say journalists, to a kind of one-stop shopping place to see what's happening in science. They would go to scienceblogs.com. So being on that platform made, all of us bloggers there very visible, taught us how to be responsible bloggers even more than we were before, kind of fact-checking ourselves better and being very careful about what we put out there because we saw how many eyes are on us. But it was also a great visibility for each one of us individually, and a lot of us got things out of there, you know, book deals. And I got a job with PLOS right in the comments of my blog post, which was titled "I Want This Job" and a copy and paste of their job description, which is a nice way of getting a job, which just shows that they are kind of cutting edge. They actually go around science blogs and see who mentions them, and then post in the comments. Should we consider this to be a formal application? And next comment is mine. Yes,
it's my application. Yes.
Then we switched to email and phone, and then I went there, interviewed, and got the job. A lot of speaking gigs and a lot of people got a lot out of it. And we got a stamp of approval by being picked and chosen by hand by a media organization. So we were treated as media. Although, some of the bloggers say, well, I'm not a journalist. I'm not either. But once you're in Google News and once you are on a platform that mainstream media is using as your source of science news, you are media, want it or not, and you better behave that way.
Right. Have you seen a lot of individuals not behave that way? I mean, for the most part, in terms of the science bloggers that I read regularly, they're all pretty well behaved. They maybe step out on the opinionating platform every once in a while, but.
Well, yeah, we all do. I mean, it's very easy to click publish and then regret it in the morning. So we've all been there. But if you're just focusing and you're in the world of science blogging, sometimes you get very irked by this blogger saying this or that. But go out to some other blogospheres and see. Hey, science bloggers are actually quite well behaved in comparison with some other communities, and we tend to have much better. Common threads as far as a lot of people who come to science blogs are interested in science to begin with and often have some expertise. Maybe they're scientists themselves. So often our common threads can be quite enlightening and interesting and can get quite technical even sometimes on some topics.
Yeah, one of the things I love about science blogs is the fact that you can get news from people's labs right out of the people who work in those labs. The scientists who are doing research, they tell you about it sometimes. Or a paper comes out and maybe the media treats it one way, but you can go to the science blogs and there's somebody who's broken down the paper, the scientific paper, point by point, and can tell you what's really happening and why the media is getting it wrong. So that's one aspect of blogging that I really appreciate. It's kind of the fact checking for the media, in a sense.
Yeah. And I think that there's always a lot of fighting bloggers versus journalists. I think this is actually a symbiotic relationship that a lot of mainstream journalists have learned a lot from being criticized by the bloggers who are experts in the field, so they don't make the same mistakes. I think they've been made better, and you know, they're careful because they know they're watched by people who have pretty big megaphones themselves, and actually have the expertise. So I think you know, bloggers and journalists are kind of, you know, watching each other and learning from each other how to write better and how to think better and how to present science better. And I think we are all together better off because of that, even if there are, you know, sometimes grumbles and grudges, and nobody likes to be criticized. But, you know, you internalize those criticisms and you don't make the same mistake next time. Even if you're angry today, you've learned something. But the other thing that you first mentioned is that a lot of science bloggers write things that reveal some of their personality, and also, you know, they talk about life in, you know, what it means to be a scientist. That that's one of the biggest things that science blogosphere has done, and that is humanize scientists. You know, we are people like anybody else. We are right. not antisocial, or you know, people with no social skills and no writing skills and no knowledge of humanities, never read Shakespeare, never watched a movie. Obviously, we are interested in so many other things. We have all the good and bad sides that any human being has, and just seeing that is probably eye-opening for a lot of people. That, you know, we're human and we're just like anybody else. Science is our passion. Science is for a lot of us a job, not for me anymore, but something related to science is. I think it's one of the best things the science blogosphere has done.
I've seen the science blogosphere really grow over the last several years. I think that it's just blossomed. From the time that I started paying attention to it, I started my blog back in 2005. And in the last 5 years, I've seen so many new faces come in. I've seen just so many people getting involved in science blogging. What do you think has really promoted that trend? Do you have any ideas?
The earliest science blogs came out of techie blogosphere. So those are mostly math and computer science, occasionally a physics blog. There are just a few of them, and they're not that well known. Then the second group of science bloggers emerged out of political blogosphere, like myself. And a lot of what we were writing about is really pushback against creationism, a lot of dissection of pseudoscientific claims, medical quackery. So that whole second generation has emerged in, you know, 03, 04, 05. And then a big kind of precipitating moment was the foundation of scienceblogs.com by Seed Media. Suddenly there's a one-stop shopping place for a lot of popular science bloggers, right, where a lot of people saw science blogs for the first time, and a lot of them realized, hey, I can do that too. And so there emerged kind of a third generation, which is now counting in thousands of bloggers who have never written about politics or tech, who have just started as science bloggers, covering science news and, you know, science basics or science education, absolutely wonderfully, at, you know, different reading levels and for different audiences. Some are targeting more their peers, and then maybe at a higher level. Others are targeting a really lay audience, you know, their kids and their grandmothers, explaining things in as simple language as possible. So they span the whole spectrum of different audiences and different levels of difficulty of understanding the material, or having to have scientific background or not, which is something that mainstream media cannot do. They're kind of tied to one particular level of, you know, a reading level. I don't know what it is, sixth grade or something like that. Can't go below, can't go above.
Right.
Science bloggers have the freedom to expand that, and that has provided for the interested audience, the science, you know, information and science news at whichever level they are ready for, and not just that one level that the traditional media can provide for, which is absolutely wonderful. So in 2005, I was capable of reading every single English language science blog in the world. Right now, I'm probably aware of 5% of them at best, and I try. There's gazillions of wonderful science blogs out there written by a number of interesting people from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of ages, stages of their of their scientific careers or getting out of science and as far as doing research, but doing something else science related, being science education or science journalism, writing books, anything like that.
Recently there was a kind of upset at science blogs. Now, science blogs, the way you describe it, it kind of makes me think of kind of how iTunes was for podcasting, where suddenly there was a central place for people to find podcasts, and science podcasts and podcasts of all kinds kind of exploded. It became a great way for people to find valuable audio content. Now, science blogs, there was the Pepsi scandal. I don't know if you want to call it a scandal or not, but where they started a blog that was sponsored by a corporation, the corporation being Pepsi, I believe. And the way that it ended up being put out was that it didn't really it put it forward as being a regular science blog type of blog and not as much of a sponsored blog as it was. And it seemed like it was kind of underhanded to a lot of the bloggers on science blogs. And I've noticed since that event, you've moved your blog. You're no longer at science blogs anymore, and you're at your own URL, blog.coternix.org. What led you to leave, to take the exodus?
It was a heart-wrenching 10 days of me making that decision. What happened is that Seed made a tactical mistake. There were sponsored blogs on science blogs before, but they were not paid either way. Nobody paid anybody. And they were hosted by, you know, one of us or somebody independent. What was different with Pepsi blog is that it was paid by Pepsi, and it was run and written entirely by employees of the Pepsi company, and it was supposed to be about food. And not everything they make is very healthy food. And so this is what is in journalism known as breaching the wall between advertising and editorial. And their blog looked exactly just like my blog, for instance. So that would erode the reputation for all of us who you know, some of us is taking a lot into our reputation for especially people who are fighting against medical quackery, for instance, or, you know, anti-vaccination movement. They always get called, you know, pharma shills or some kind of corporate shills, although they are very independent. So this would undermine their argument because there's a corporate blog right next door. So the first to notice this really were the medical bloggers and bloggers who are professionally journalists. They realized immediately what happened, and in their blog post, which they immediately put up, and you know, hats off to Seed. They always gave us full editorial freedom, so we were always free to criticize them on our blogs, and there was never a problem. So several bloggers wrote why they're leaving or why they're not leaving. It is really the journalist bloggers that put it most clearly what really happened that made us so unhappy, and explained to us why are we feeling so uneasy about this blog, because it's something that does have precedent in journalism before advertising posing as editorial content of a magazine or a newspaper. And so a number of people left, like on the first day. And then there was kind of a limbo situation, and I was, you know, thinking and, you know, weighing pros and cons. And, you know, after about 10 days, I wrote a long blog post and I left. I decided that I would have to go independent and kind of work on my own reputation, and also work on rebuilding the science blogging ecosystem, the reputation of the entire ecosystem. And what happened is something that you know, I immediately predicted, that a lot of other media organizations are going to jump into the fray, building their own science blogging networks, because suddenly, because of this maybe temporary, but at that time very acutely seen loss of reputation by science blogs, everybody saw an opening. Science blogs is now not the only place to look for science online. There are other places. There are networks on, you know, Discover, and very soon after that on Wired and The Guardian and PLOS, and a number of bloggers' collectives that built their own networks, completely, you know, just pitching in, you know, a few bucks each to pay for the server, and not having any advertising whatsoever, like Scientopia and Field of Science and Lab Spaces and Science 3.0. So there's a growing number of networks. So it became kind of a often repeated sentiment on, for instance, on Twitter: how am I going to keep up with all these bloggers? They are moving everywhere. Some are going independent, joining other networks. The networks are springing up every day. How is one to follow everybody? So Anton Zeiker, Dave Munger, and myself put together a website, a simple website, which is an aggregator of aggregators. It's scienceblogging.org, and we just imported feeds from all the networks and some, you know, kind of collections of independent bloggers, some science news sites, put them all together. A couple of other people joined us since, and so we are now trying to make a more sophisticated website, kind of a 2.0 version that we hope to unveil at Science Online 2011, which will have some more capabilities of tagging and browsing and searching and kind of individualizing one's experience for the users to be able to use the site the way it fits their interests and their needs. So that kind of helped. And then, you know, soon after I left Science Blogs, and I was briefly initially involved in helping with setting up the PLOS blog network and the Scientopia blog network, I was approached by Scientific American, and after, you know, a couple of weeks of negotiations, I signed up to develop and launch and then run a science blogging network under the banner of Scientific American. That will take, you know, a couple of months to launch, but I'm very excited. I was just at the New York offices last 3 days, kind of putting the first kind of foundation stones on the whole edifice. So it's exciting time for me personally. It's it's wonderful to be able to start from scratch and kind of take my vision and turn it into reality. And it's a wonderful people to work with, and a great brand to work under. So it's going to be exciting for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any thoughts on what will make a great blog network? I mean, coming from starting with Science Blogs and working with them and seeing how they worked, and now starting to work as the chief editor of the Scientific American blogs, do you have any ideas of what would make a really great network?
I'm not supposed to tell you yet.
Ah! Try and get it out of you.
No. The thing is, every network is going to be different, and those existing networks are all different, and they have different concepts, they have different people on there, they have different target audiences, different goals, and I think that's wonderful. You shouldn't have, 50 networks that are carbon copies of each other. I think what has emerged after the PepsiGate is that all these networks should not be seeing each other so much as competition as collaborators. We can work together because science in the media gets such a small amount of coverage that we need to work together to push and promote and popularize science and to educate people about science. And we are in the same business, and we can help each other. We can drive each other's traffic. It's best for all of us. This is a kind of a new way of feeling and thinking. Everybody is feeling very benevolently about everybody else. There's a lot of crosstalk between different networks. I mean, a lot of people who are in scienceblogs.com refugees have landed on a variety of different networks, and they are still friends. They still talk to each other. They still read each other. They still link to each other. They still kind of influence their own new neighbors in that direction. So I see a much more intertwined network of networks than it was before. They're not going to be they already are not as isolated from each other. They don't see each other as, deadly competition. We are in the same business. Let's help each other what we do. And each network is going to have its own niche, its own part, playing its own part in that ecosystem. So, different networks are going to be strong at one thing, and they'll, as Jeff Jarvis said, do what you do best and link to the rest. And so each of the networks has something that it does best. And why not link to the others who do something else best?
Right. Make everyone lift everyone up. The rising tide lifts all ships.
Exactly. That's right. And we take over the media like this.
That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah, just a sea change in the way that science is treated in the media, and a whole new push for a different kind of science media.
I hope so. We need it. A lot of important issues of our times that affect, for instance, our policy are very much reliant on understanding the science that goes into it. Global warming, for instance.
Very much so. And then many other topics that you brought up earlier in the show. We started talking this hour about the Science Online Conference. We're starting to come to the end of the hour. So I'm just wondering if people are interested in the Science Online Conference, finding out more about it, where can they go?
The website is scienceonline2011.com. So it's all one word, and then .com, Science Online 2011. And when you go there, there's several buttons that you can click. There is a blog, and there is a wiki, which is the organizing wiki, where everybody can edit all the pages as we... not available. That's not a good sign. It was available a minute ago when I last checked. Anyway, you can check later. We'll check on the server. Where, for instance, we have there's already a lot of information on there, but there is a page called Program Suggestions, where people are, just by editing that page, usually volunteering to lead a session on a particular topic, and then after a while, it is going to crystallize into the actual program, and then we'll probably lock that page, and I'll be the only one administering it, so that we have a program in place by January. And the sessions themselves are unconferency in the sense that the way Dave Weiner said it originally, the some knowledge and wisdom of people in the room is always greater than the knowledge and wisdom of the person on the stage. So the person on the stage is really a moderator, not a speaker. You know, a 5-minute, 10-minute introduction just to set the kind of the topic and the theme and the goal of the session. And then it's a discussion. And then discussion afterwards, you know, spills into the hallways and the, you know, dinner afterwards. And often results in some action, you know, starting a new organization, starting a new website, or doing something together, a collaboration. Often these sessions don't end when the time runs out.
Yeah, I know leaving the conference last year, I felt really inspired, and I'd met a lot of people who I'd only previously met on online or only knew them by their online handles. And so it was really an amazing time to be able to get together and meet face to face, have discussions in real time, you know, in person. And I think it did lead to a lot of collaborations, and a lot of neat new ideas came out of it. So I hope that the same thing happens for this year's conference, Science Online 2011, which, because of the timing, I don't think I'm going to be able to go this year. So, unfortunately,
I understand.
Unfortunately, there's a certain point that they stop letting you get on planes when you're pregnant. So,
I know. But you'll be able to watch us online. So, we'll try to, you know, live stream everything, and Twitter is going to be a big deal, like last time. I think last year we had something like 8,000 tweets in a day and a half. So there's plenty of ways to get informed in real time what is happening on there. But then you'll be back 2 years from now.
Absolutely. Ready to go. Better than ever.
Of course.
That's right. And your blog, I'd love to be able to, so your blog is at blog.coternix.org.
That's right. For now, until there's a Scientific America network, and then I'll be there.
And then you'll be at Scientific American. So you're staying independent for the short term, not for the long
yes.
term.
Yes, which is why I'm not putting a lot of effort into making my blog being looking very beautiful. that will come with you know, wonderful artists and designers at Scientific American with all their, you know, 165 years of expertise in doing that. So my blog is just a simple WordPress blog that has all my archives ready, and I can, you know, update my readers on all sorts of stuff.
And Twitter. You're on Twitter as well, right?
Yes, at Boraz, B-O-R-A-Z.
Oops, let me get the right.
Or you can just go to my, I have a homepage, coternix.org, which has links to all, you know, everywhere I am online, my blog and Twitter and friend feed and Facebook and everywhere else that you can find, you know, Nature Network and YouTube. So you can friend me where you want to, and also link to scienceinthetriangle.org. This is a local science blog that I contribute to, which is everything here in the triangle that has to do with science is kind of intertwined. It's often the same people involved. There's a SCONC, which is Science Communicators of North Carolina, kind of a loose organization of writers who often write for Charlotte Observer and News and Observer Monday science section. They also write for a scienceinthetriangle.org blog. They all show up at Science Online or a conference and often lead sessions. Many of them are bloggers. Almost every network actually has at least one blogger from North Carolina, which is a interesting. North Carolina is full of good science bloggers due to this whole, you know, long tradition of blogging and a long tradition in science. So that's not surprising. And then, you know, the scienceblogging.org, the website, look, you know, found here, researchblogging.org, which compiles blog posts that are specifically covering peer-reviewed literature. That was founded by Dave Munger at Davidson near Charlotte. and Open Laboratory, which is an anthology of the best writing on science blogs that usually comes out every year just in time for Science Online Conference, and sometimes a couple of days later, depends on the year. So those are all kind of bits and pieces of a larger framework of science communication in the area, which spills to the global audience.
That's fabulous. It seems like there's just a wealth of information out there. It just takes a little bit of interest and a little bit of time for people to dig into it, and then hopefully they'll get hooked.
I hope so. It's fun. It's great fun. Reading science blogs is great fun. I do that all day long.
I would hope that you do with your profession. The way your career is going, I hope you pay attention to the blogs.
I sort of do.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Bora. It's been great talking with you today, and I know for a fact that people are going to be digging into Science Online 2011, and that it's going to be a great conference again this year. Wish you all the luck in getting all of the details organized and settled for this year's location and everything that all the details that go into creating a conference. So good luck with that, you and Anton. And with your blogs and with Scientific American, I hope that your visions do become a reality there. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me here, and great to see you on screen. And sooner or later, we'll meet again in person. Yeah, have a baby first.
Yeah, it'll happen. I'll get this little thing out of the way, and then be back on a plane in no time. No. All right, everybody, this has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki, and you can subscribe to this program by visiting twit.tv/Kiki, K-I-K-I. You can find videos of it there. You can video, audio, all sorts of different qualities, depending on your bandwidth abilities. We aim to please here at Twit. Additionally, you can find me online as Dr. Kiki. I'm Dr. Kiki on Twitter, and I have a Facebook fan page for Dr. Kiki. You can Google Dr. Kiki. You'll find all sorts of stuff out there. It's pretty simple. Next week, we are going to be talking about the pain that the fishes feel. It's really true. A new book out by Dr. Victoria Braithwaite. We're going to be speaking with her next week about the pain and fish. Could be a really interesting conversation. A lot of the people out there, I'm sure you don't think about how much pain those fish go through when they have a hook in their lip. Probably don't. But anyway, we'll be talking about it. So I hope that you will join us again next week. Thanks for joining us this week. And if nothing else, I hope this hour made your world a whole lot more interesting. Thanks for watching.